Welcome to First Fuel, a fortnightly podcast bringing you perspectives on the role of energy efficiency, energy management, demand response and the energy transition taking place in Australia and around the world. I'm Luke Menzel, CEO of the Energy Efficiency Council, and this week I'm joined by Damien Moyse, who's just finished up a 12-year stint as Policy and Research Manager at Renew. Welcome, Damien, and I can reveal that yesterday was, theoretically at least, your last day at Renew, which leads to the obvious question, how was the party?
Thanks, Luke. Yeah, hi, everybody. Thanks for having me. Unfortunately, Renew's head office and my home is based in Melbourne and just gone through a temporary lockdown there. So, yes, the last day was yesterday, tidying up a few things today. These things never kind of quite finish at 5 o'clock, but the party has been postponed. The Premier's sort of put the kibosh on that this week. So maybe in another week or so, we'll be allowed to, you know, take 10 or 15 people to a pub somewhere, maybe a rooftop where we can all stand socially distant and, have a drink.
Yeah, well, I mean, stories of folk that have their plans derailed over the last week have been flying thick and fast, but obviously good news that we've emerged from the lockdown relatively quickly, and really excited to have you on the show. Renew, formerly known as the Alternative Technology Association, has been around for, a bit over 40 years?
Yeah, 1980. Yep.
Yeah, there you go. And I suppose if listeners are interested in the history, we can direct them to episode 17 of First Fuel, which delved into some of the backstory with former CEO Donna Luckman. But maybe you could start by telling us a bit about why you were brought on way back in 2008 and what you were tasked with.
So, yeah, I've been thinking about that last few days. How did this all start? I mean, back sort of mid-2000s, 2008, Renew had been, I mean, as we just said, started in 1980. It was, you know, it's a membership organisation. It was started by a bunch of engineers and electricians that wanted to really look at technology as sort of a solution to environmental and sustainability issues. Obviously, the primary magazine had been around since then, Renew, or used to be called Soft Technology, and lots of kind of DIY and those kind of, sharing experiences and projects and DIY projects kind of being done throughout the membership, you know, thousands of kind of members around the country. And that's kind of what went on for really, you know, sort of 20 years or so. And I guess in the mid-2000s, you know, just before my time, the organization really wanted to get a bit more into projects and advocacy, and actually particularly from, I suppose, an organizational perspective, not just the members doing things in their homes, but certainly engaging more in the policy debate around emissions and around where the energy market's going, but also kind of develop more of a projects team. So one of the first formal kind of projects that was done just before I started was actually the first rules around grid connecting a solar system to the, you know, the low voltage distribution network. Kane Thornton, who's the long been the CEO of the Clean Energy Council, he basically used to do my job at ATA and wrote those kind of first rules, and that was great, and that really kind of set Renew up, or ATA at the time, to kind of get into that project and advocacy sort of space. So that's what happened with me. I arrived in 2008, employed as basically a consumer advocate to advocate on behalf of owners of solar and kind of distributed generation and distributed energy assets, and kind of make their journey, particularly in the energy market, easier, provide the opportunities, pathways for them to kind of do the things that they wanted to do. But then also, you know, the organization wanted to get involved in some of the bigger debates. So the big debates at the time were obviously the emissions trading scheme. So this is just after Kevin Rudd's elected and we signed Kyoto, and then, you know, the first, what was it, carbon pollution reduction scheme kind of draft frameworks are being put up, and Renew, ATA at the time, wanted to engage in that. The mandatory renewable energy target, the MRET as it used to be called, but the RET now, or recently, that used to be a 2% target by 2010 when I started, and again, federal government under Kevin Rudd wanted to lift that to a 20% target by 2020. And, you know, there was lots of little issues within that kind of affected ATA members and solar owners, and we wanted to engage in that. Feed-in tariffs is another big one. Feed-in tariffs probably really took most of my time in the first few years. They were that the RET stuff and the emissions stuff had been bubbling along, but feed-in tariffs had really just started 2008, 2009, and we campaigned heavily for the first premium feed-in tariff in Victoria. That was kind of throughout 2009. We campaigned heavily in sort of New South Wales and particularly SA as well, engaged to a lesser extent in other states. A lot of my time was first of all trying to understand what these things did and how they worked and what the arguments for and against them were in the market.
So it strikes me that one of the real points of differentiation, particularly at that time, was obviously ATA with this, you know, let's call it a fairly wonky membership. They're sort of probably early adopters. I think we can describe the ATA membership certainly back in the day. You know, really interested in the technology and the application of the technology. But then up against that, you had, you know, these big sort of policy developments, which had the aim of kind of scaling up technology that had been bubbling along under the surface for a long time. But in many of those conversations, you didn't really have a consumer voice. And so it's almost like if you didn't have an ATA to sort of step up at that moment, you almost would have had to create one so that there was a consumer's perspective being brought to some of those policy debates. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, that's right. There's certainly, there wasn't a lot of, you know, there's a lot of good consumer-based kind of renewable energy and sustainability organizations now around that are engaging in the energy kind of debate. Back then, you had still very good, you know, social policy, low-income kind of focused consumer advocates, but there wasn't too many that sort of understood some of these weird new technologies that were coming in. That was the role that ATA could play. The members knew how these systems worked. They knew what they wanted in terms of their engagement, particularly with the energy market and with distributors and retailers. Obviously, governments, federal and state governments, were looking at various kind of overarching policy mechanisms. And so, yeah, one of the good parts of the role is I was able to then go, okay, well, this is kind of what the government's kind of, you know, suggesting or where they want to go at a national or a state level, but how's that actually going to work for people in their homes who want to use technology or who want to look at energy efficiency options or buy green power and have green power actually make a difference environmentally? That was a big one early on. And so then I could just ask the members, well, how do you think this is going to actually practically work? And some things, that'll be fantastic, and other things really not happy about. And then we're able to then formulate, I suppose, advocacy positions based on those members' experience. And this is certainly at a time where I came from town planning. I didn't know the difference between a kilowatt and a kilowatt hour. And so I had to rely on the members more than anything really to tell me, well, do you think some of this stuff's going to work or not? And how's this going to impact the way that you want to kind of develop your sustainable home or even some of your DIY projects or that sort of thing in the context of the broader sort of policy shift.
Mm. And so you had that incredible resource in terms of the ATA membership to draw on. But obviously a key part of your role has been building out the evidence and research base on some of these really critical issues as well. Just observing over the journey, it seems like there's been a really virtuous circle between, you know, identifying policy issues where the evidence base perhaps isn't there or you really need to do a deep dive, building up a project that allows you to do that deep dive and feed it back into the advocacy. Is that kind of how it's worked?
Yeah, that's very much how it's worked, and it's been the beauty of the organisation. It still is. So you've got 11,000 members. They're all across the country, and as we know, energy, the states and territories are all very different in terms of the way energy policy and tariffs and different things work. So getting that experience fed into when you're thinking about policy or kind of research projects is really important. So you kind of, and the members, you know, particularly early on, again, the first kind of 5 years, they're telling me, yeah, this technology's got legs. This is going to go somewhere. This doesn't. Small wind turbines on roofs, come on. This is not, you know, this is not going to happen. And getting that feedback and getting that just on the ground reality about what's possible and what isn't, it's really, really useful, because then you can kind of, you know, as we all know, climate energy policy is pretty controversial, lots of debates and lots of, you know, sometimes heated conversations with different stakeholders and so forth. But I and ATA were able to kind of engage in that stuff, but then just talk at a very practical level. Well, all right, there's different views on this stuff, but just practically here, you know, this is either going to be cheaper, or this you're not going to be able to connect to the grid, or this doesn't actually generate electricity very much. This does. And you can kind of, we could kind of talk at that practical level and then work out, okay, well, this is sure the ATA is the early adopters, the first 5% of the market or whatever. But if we're then thinking about having 50, 60, 70% of the market do this, what, when you're scaling up, what's likely to then work at a larger policy level? And it was really great then to be able to, I mean, we had all that experience from the membership a long time before I started, but then that the last 10, 12 years we've been able to, because we had the members and we're sort of, you know, a legitimate consumer organization, even though we are a bit wonky, we're able to then work with other project partners and get funding from the likes of sort of Energy Consumers Australia or Consumer Advocacy Panel at the time and other funders out there who would then actually give us some dollars to develop some research projects and sort of engagement projects where we could take the kind of member experience and then look at that in a larger scale and go, okay, well, this has really got what's going to work in the future, for particularly for households. Renew's very household focused given the nature of the membership, and some of this stuff isn't really that useful either, or not worth focusing on, or needs some policy change. So yeah, that kind of iterative circular sort of process has always been there with Renew, and it always can be. It's there. It's the beauty of kind of being able to talk to actually people on the ground that are trying to do things.
And I guess really important in what's been, as you say, a decade of contention around energy and climate policy. You know, whether, you know, there's claims, both well-founded and spurious, being thrown around almost on a daily basis. To have organisations like Renew working through the issues, doing the research, testing the propositions, and coming up with some often hard numbers and some rigorous technical or economic analysis that can put some of the furphies to rest, and, you know, perhaps pose better questions that we all need to grapple with as we work our way through this energy transition.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we were very much, there was a very strong kind of consumer advocacy sector still at that time, in that sort of late 2000s, early 2010s. Again, a lot of organizations, as I say, really focus more on social policy, vulnerable consumers, that kind of thing. And Renew's always been cognizant of those issues, but certainly not necessarily representing those kind of consumers, particularly in the energy market. But we were representing a different consumer base with different kind of interests and different skill sets. And so then, you know, you get, I mean, particularly back then, there was a lot of kind of potential conflict points between environmental outcomes and social policy outcomes, you know, things putting up costs and having impacts on, you know, like for Victoria, it used to be that around a third of electricity customers were on concessions. And so, and that's something, you know, I was very keen, obviously, on the renewable side, energy efficiency side, but I didn't really fully understand the impacts of some renewable energy or other, you know, climate policies that those impacts might have on other types of consumers in the market. And so then, yeah, engaging where we could bring that a certain perspective from the Renew membership or the ATA membership, but then kind of engaging with that kind of broader consumer sector, you know, having the debates, having the disagreements, but then trying to find better data and trying to find, okay, how will this actually work out in reality? And then I think over, you know, the course of a few years, the environment sector and the social policy sector has gotten better at working together and trying to find some policy mechanisms which can lead to some better sort of balanced outcomes.
And I think there's been an increasing recognition about how crucial the perspective of the consumer is in the midst of, you know, the transition that we're all working our way through. And organisations like Energy Consumers Australia have played a really important role in bringing almost different knowledge domains together, the different lenses on the consumer experience, and also, you know, to some degree, I think it's fair to say too, the energy sector has gotten a lot more sophisticated in the way it thinks about that as well, and the need to put consumer interests first.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. I mean, just recalling the first, you know, sort of 3 or 4 years, I mean, you look at the way network businesses and retailers now, particularly network businesses, the way they do consumer engagement, it's vastly different than, you know, 2008, 9, 10, 11, those years. I remember AEMO used to run just basically training courses on how does the NEM, the National Electricity Market, work? How does the wholesale market work? How does the regulation of networks work? You could do like a 3-day introductory course to the NEM. And given my town planning background, I was like, I need to do that. And I remember ringing or emailing someone an email, can I do this course? Oh, no, sorry, we don't offer that to consumers. We only offer it to the industry. We offer it to other network people working in network businesses and people working in retailers. And I was like, what, are you joking? So then after, you know, probably about a year of working with people in the previous version of ECA and other particularly social policy organizations, and us all getting a bit grumpy and saying, hang on a minute, we're part of this ball game too. You know, then those boundaries were broadened. But yeah, as I say, the way that most of the industry now does engagement and talks to each other, it's just a vastly different world than it used to be.
The other sort of thing that occurs to me in terms of the evolution of the conversation in the time you've been at ATA and then Renew, I'd be interested to sort of get a sense check from you on. I imagine within the ATA membership, there's sort of, you know, there's almost a philosophical disposition to a bit of self-sufficiency. The idea that you'd row your own boat, you know, the whole disconnecting from the grid thing, you know, energy efficiency and solar panels and batteries and the like. But then so much of your work is actually about how you scale up this technology and, you know, and I think the consensus we've arrived at is that the grid is absolutely, you know, essential to that, and it's in the interests of consumers that we have that infrastructure there, and it's evolved to incorporate the new technology. Do you want to just talk a little bit about those different currents in the membership of the ATA, and I guess in the conversation we've been having in Australia over the journey?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, sort of makes me smile listening to some of those comments, because it's right on the mark. So yeah, you know, unsurprisingly, ATA does. It comes from that background of, you know, as I say, it was literally engineers and electricians that started the organization. They, of course, want to do things in their sheds, and they want to, you know, stick it to the retailer man and not pay their energy bill, and they're trying to do as much as possible to kind of, you know, be self-sufficient in lots of different ways, not just energy. So that self-sufficiency off-grid thing has always been a core theme, and particularly in the first 20 years of the organization, really. It sits very much in that area. And, you know, for me, kind of coming to 2008, again, as I said, you know, not particularly, I've always said I'm not an engineer or an economist. So, you know, that's kind of almost the two disciplines that you need in this area. But so I'm listening to the ATA membership at the time, and the projects team's not just me. That we've always had sort of four or five people, sometimes more, in the projects team, and we're listening to the membership, and obviously they've got things that they want to do in terms of within that kind of self-sufficiency, independence banner. And I think it really took us probably two or three, maybe even 4 years, to really fully understand. I couldn't work out in the early days, what are we actually calling for here as an organization? Are we actually saying that we want, I don't know, in 2030, we want 80% of Australian homes to be off the electricity grid? Is that what we're saying? But staying on the gas grid. And we used to have these debates internally about, you know, what is the optimal ATA house in the future? What are we, because our members, I mean, some of our members had strong views on this, but a lot of other members are just asking us, what should they do? Should they go off grid? Should they stay on grid? What should they do with gas? This is a long time before the current narrative around gas is, you know, playing out. And it took us a few years to work it out. And I think it probably really wasn't until, I don't know, maybe 2012 or 2013, where, you know, me and my team, particularly another guy, did a lot of work with this, Craig Memory, and we formally, I guess, started saying, and Donna too, Donna Luckman, previous CEO, we formally started saying to the membership, look, the grid is good. the grid
is grid is good.
Yeah, that's right. We've sort of finally come to the view that the grid actually has a lot of benefit. We've all spent, what did we spend? $50 billion or something between about 2009 and 2015 on the grid, and all of the billions that were spent in the 100 years before that. The grid is good. The grid actually, when you are connected to it, if you have a solar system, you can share renewable energy with your neighbors and, you know, further get better use out of that renewable energy. And by the way, when you have an off-grid system, you lose 30% of the annual energy in summer because it's just wasted. It goes nowhere. Mm-hmm. And so, but, you know, it took us a while to kind of work this stuff out. And again, some members had you know, sort of competing views on this stuff. But we, around that time, we really did change our kind of philosophy that, okay, well, there's always going to be the DIYers, and there's always, I mean, I think 40% of ATA's membership used to be rural, regional. I'm not sure. It's probably still around a third. And there's always markets and spaces and situations where that off-grid stuff makes sense. But, you know, off-grid's got its own sort of complications and pros and cons. But in the end, we sort of came out very strongly. And I think the other side of that, you know, 2012-13, you've got these enormous solar systems going, and they're not 1 kilowatt systems anymore. You've got 3 and 4 and 5 kilowatt systems where they're generating twice as much electricity that you need over the course of a year. And we're like, hang on a minute, if you're not connected to the grid, a lot of this stuff's going to be wasted. And if you're not, if you don't have enough electrical load, you're exporting like 90% of your energy to the grid. So we really started to go, hang on a minute, the grid is good for most people, urban, big towns and so forth. You want a grid connection. And really the question at that point started to become more around, well, what in that context, what's actually the role of some of your other fuels, obviously particularly either mains or bottled gas?
Which has been one of the key themes in the research agenda over the last 12 years, Damien. I actually went back and looked at the research page on the Renew website, and the first report that's posted there is from 2008. And it's an incredible legacy that you and, as you say, the rest of the team have left over the last 12 years. Do you want to just give me some highlights? What are the things that you're particularly proud of when you think back on I guess some of the research you've done, some of the debates you've contributed to over the journey?
Yeah, I guess the electrification stuff, and just kind of, you know, given where we're at the moment, given where my headspace is at and sort of where the debate's at, that's probably the one that sticks out more than anything. So, as I say, kind of 2010, 2011, 2012, we're seeing this massive difference that people aren't sticking in 1 kilowatt systems anymore. They're putting in these quite, you know, at that time, quite large systems that costs are just falling through the floor, and the capacity of these panels is going through the roof. And so that's the point. I remember in 2012, we're like, well, what does that mean in terms of bills and energy use, particularly for homes? We're very much focused on the household side. And so that's when we started to do a few kind of little basic energy and economic models around the potential for electrification for new homes or for existing homes. We started to look a bit more closely at, well, what are the major energy loads for a house? It's really heating, cooling, and hot water. How do they work in this context? What fuel types do they typically have? What energy loads do they typically have? And we started doing our sort of first kind of toe in the water sort of analyses around that. 2014, we got a big grant from ECA at the time and did kind of a big NEM-wide kind of household fuel choice, electricity versus gas kind of comparison there. And then we redid that again in 2018, about 4 years later. And then a lot of that whole stream of work and I guess of research, it's kind of flowed out into working for property developers, housing developers, looking at how to best set up new estates and advising builders on not just electrification, but, you know, how do you combine electrification and renewable energy and thermal efficiency of the building as well, and what's kind of the best sort of sweet spots for that. And so all of that work really has grown a lot from that time, sort of about, you know, 8 or 9 years ago. And I suppose for me now, given where a lot of our advocacy positions are at, that's kind of one that really does stand out. The other stuff, I mean, the first 5 years, as I say, was really about feed-in tariffs and getting them up and running. And, there was swings and roundabouts with feed-in tariffs. We got some of that wrong in terms of some of the costs that came out of that, and adjustments were made. And I think the main thing that I'm pleased about, and it's not just ATA Renew doing this, it's in combination with other groups, but we managed to peg the feed-in tariffs once they all kind of, most of them, the Victorian one hasn't ended, but once most of them ended around 2014-15, it was like, okay, well, once the premium one goes, that's it. Governments will get rid of feed-in tariffs again. And we were always, and many other organisations were always like, hang on a minute, a kilowatt hour has a value. It doesn't matter where it comes from. If it comes from a solar system, it's got almost the same value as any other kilowatt hour in the grid. And so then at the very least, you've got to peg feed-in tariffs to wholesale prices of electricity. And largely that's what's happened in most of the states. And so it's great now, kind of, you know, 5 or 6 years on after most of the feed-in tariffs have closed. They're still going, which is good. And then kind of, you know, for us, kind of a lot of the time, my 12 years there has been very focused on energy. But the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, we've really gotten also, we've still kept the energy side of things up, but then also really started to think properly about housing, you know, building design and thermal efficiency. And particularly, the members were always interested in that and doing their own projects. And that was always good. But engaging more in the policy debate around it. So the National Construction Code, 3 yearly reviews, obviously this current one's pretty important for residential, and then what can we do in existing homes from a thermal efficiency point of view, and then trying to link those two together. How does the housing stuff and the energy sort of market and technology stuff work in tandem for the best outcome possible, both environmentally and economically for consumers? So I think that housing stuff in the last kind of 4 or 5 years has been a key one as well.
Which kind of reflects, you know, the journey that we've gone on as a sector in terms of the understanding more and more the intersections between these different regulatory regimes, you know, to get that optimal outcome that you're talking about in terms of, you know, renewable energy and electrification and, you know, hopefully a building with good thermal performance. You're starting to deal with, you know, ministers, parts of government, regulations that traditionally have had nothing to do with each other, but need increasingly to be, you know, very well integrated to deliver an optimal outcome, both for individuals and from a society-wide point of view. I think it's really positive, actually, the degree to which we've observed, because the Energy Efficiency Council, you know, sits at this weird intersection between a lot of these debates. Just players from different realms starting to engage with each other in a much more proactive way. And I think Renew's probably always been in that space, sort of similar sort of, you know, liminal space that the EEC's occupied as well.
Yeah, no, it's been great. I mean, I've been very lucky, really, in terms of, you know, the way kind of the external world has developed, technologies developed, policies developed. It's given us a huge amount of opportunities to kind of play in these spaces. And I mean, I've always been really lucky having great people in the team. As I said, I was a town planner that knew nothing, but you know, Renew and ATO was an organisation that was attractive to people to come and work in our team, and people with actual qualifications in these areas, like engineers and economists and so forth. And so, you know, along the way, we've always had a pretty good little kind of projects team. And I suppose the thing I've always been really pleased about that is because of the nature of Renew, it's a small organisation. It's a not-for-profit. It's not particularly hierarchical or bureaucratic. And so we can engage in debates pretty quickly. We can do a bit of, you know, some analysis in-house, particularly when we've got some smart people in the team, and we can then engage in that debate pretty quickly, sort of constructively, and we can just say what we think. You know, I've worked in governments and I've worked for sort of consultancy firms before, and in some of those jobs you have to be very careful, or there's really not a lot of opportunity to actually get out publicly and sort of say what you think and kind of put out a bit of analysis and sort of stand behind it. But yeah, one of the things I'm kind of most enjoyed, I guess, and always been a bit proud of my team is that, you know, we think things, we do a bit of, you know, back of the envelope, or we might actually do a bit more detailed analysis than that. And then, you know, if we come up with a position on something, then we'll put it out there and kind of stand behind it. And sometimes we get it wrong, just like everybody else, and we need to adjust and so forth. But yeah, the beauty of the organization is that it's, you know, it's independent, and you can do that. You can kind of put stuff out and then debate it. And sure, you know, through that debate, you'll probably learn a few things and might adjust your views and so forth. But it's been great on that front. And yeah, having a really good projects team on that front has allowed us to do that.
First Fuel is brought to you by the Energy Efficiency Council, a not-for-profit membership association for businesses, universities, governments, and NGOs. The Council's mission is to unlock the potential of energy efficiency to deliver healthy, comfortable buildings, productive, competitive businesses, and an affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy system for Australia. To find out how your organisation can get involved, visit eec.org.au/membership.
All right, so much has been achieved, both, you know, by Renew and you know, in the broader sector. We've made a bit of progress in terms of sustainability in the residential space, perhaps not as much as as some advocates would like, but generally moving in the right direction. But what do you regard as the big pieces of unfinished business, the areas I suppose you'd be encouraging your former colleagues at Renew to focus on in your absence?
Yeah, I did leave about a 5-page paper with my current CEO on that. So, I mean, I think there's I mean, you know, there's huge opportunities at the end of the day where we're not dealing with climate change fast enough, and yep. Households and communities still have some big opportunities around that. I mean, I think the key ones, if we kind of think, you know, the next few years, next maybe 5 years and that, it's certainly the new and existing home kind of, you know, the energy performance side of things. So the NCC, the National Construction Code debate, you know, there's the current one. Well, we're, you know, relatively confident of getting some wins in that this time, but that even if we do, that won't be the end of the ball game. Obviously, there's a real trajectory there that needs to be kind of met and delivered over the next sort of 5 to 10 years. Existing homes is really further behind the kind of new home space. So, you know, we need a nationally consistent sort of auditing framework. We need mandatory disclosure. We need minimum standards, and we need those to kind of ratchet up over time. We've got to improve the energy performance and water performance of these really poor existing housing stock that we still have. Obviously, electrification is in that mix. It has some real opportunities, I guess, in that mix for both new and existing homes and outside the residential sector too. But of course, electrification is not the solution to everything. Hydrogen and other things, obviously efficiency and other things, will play a role. So I think finding the right spaces for each of those kind of general sort of solutions is really the challenge for the next few years. And there's certainly roles for government intervention and policy in that, and obviously technology and markets will lead some of that too. I mean, for a new two, I mean, the two other ones really are obviously transport. Now we've got to find a way to you know, increase the uptake of EVs, and we've got to, I mean, Renew's always been really strong on e-bikes, and I think that has, particularly through the member experience again, and I think that that's got some really sort of good opportunities going forward. Not everybody lives needs an EV or to drive it a lot who lives in inner Melbourne or inner Sydney. And the other thing that probably Renew's going to have to really focus on and sort of be careful about too is, you know, when we're talking about solar and we're talking about, you know, heat pump hot water systems and EVs and all these things, you know, the level of accessibility for middle class to higher income earners, you know, living in owner occupied homes in cities is fantastic, but there's real accessibility issues for renters and apartment dwellers and low income households, and I think Renew's needs to kind of be more active sort of in that space and think through how and work with a lot of, you know, partners, I guess, in how we're going to look towards kind of, I suppose, a socially just transition on all of this. Otherwise, there's going to be some people, and it's not just going to be a few, that it'll be significant, that kind of get left behind or really come to the benefits of this very, very late.
Yeah, and we saw some of that debate just begin to get started with the release of the Grattan Institute's report late last year. Tony Wood and Guy Dundas just highlighting some of those issues around electrification and the potential, as you say, middle and upper income earners, you know, having a relatively straightforward pathway towards those upgrades, potentially lower income earners and renters. You know, it's emotive terminology, Damien, but stranded on the gas grid, and what that all means if that's the trajectory. And you see similar conversations playing out in other jurisdictions that are a little bit on the bleeding edge of the transition. There's a report out of California early last year that was grappling with some of the same issues and was advocating for very careful policy making from government, you know, when it comes to, you know, the trajectory of some of these transitions and how they're going to impact different parts of society in different ways, which almost brings the conversation full circle, right, to what you were saying earlier. You know, in the early 2000s, you sort of had the technology folk over here, and you had this consumer and social justice people over here. Increasingly, you know, those two conversations have to be, completely intertwined in order to deliver an outcome that both works for society and is going to, have the level of momentum and speed that we know that it needs to have.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me personally, it's kind of becoming, like I sort of said, 10 years ago, we were quite unsure about what the best kind of pathways were here, particularly from a technology and perhaps an economic perspective. And it took us a while to sort of work that out, and took not just ATA either, sort of many organizations are grappling with that stuff. I think particularly in the residential sector, the pathways now are kind of pretty clear. There's still some options, and there's still some kind of obviously details to work through, but it's pretty clear what's going to work and what isn't going to work. And unfortunately, I think the more I kind of think about it, particularly the last couple of years, what is patently obvious that is going to work does have a big accessibility question for people that either for, financial reasons or just by the housing stock that they live in, they just don't have that, the control, the ability to make those decisions. And so at that point for me, it's only really sort of government intervention to some degree that can help that out. And it needs to be done in line with an overall objective of transitioning everybody, by 2030 or 2040 or 2050, or whatever your interim or final targets are. As I say, the last time I looked at it, you still had a third of people, maybe 25-30% of electricity consumers in one state, Victoria, being on concessions. So it's not a small proportion of the population. It's significant, and it needs to be dealt with.
All right. Well, we're almost out of time, but obviously we spent most of today's chat, reflecting on the last 12 years, but I'm sure our audience is waiting with bated breath to hear what you'll be up to next. Damien, do you want to let us in on the news?
Yeah. Content-wise, more of the same.
I'm not surprised.
I haven't decided to become a florist or anything.
That's very good news.
No, I'm taking a job with the Victorian Government in the Department of Environment, Land, Water and Planning. It would be known to many people who the department does a lot of obviously energy projects and policy and a lot of energy work in the energy space. So I'm going into a team there which is looking at particularly kind of hydrogen electrification issues. So what are the roles of particularly those two things in different parts of the energy sector, obviously not just residential. And so this will be a bit of a change for me, given that I've been so residential focused for 12 years. I'm going to need to come to terms a bit more and talk a lot more with people in the commercial industrial sectors and potentially agriculture or else other sectors to work out really what, thinking about the next 5 to 10 years, particularly for Victoria, where does hydrogen make sense? Where does kind of electrification investments make sense? Where does probably efficiency make sense? Although efficiency is not, there are other parts of DELP that are kind of primarily focused on that, but it's really kind of those first two that I'll be working on and talking across government, trying to work out what's possible and then sort of engaging with industry and consumers too. So I look forward to keeping on talking to you all and look forward to seeing how a number of these issues and technologies kind of evolve over the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, we're sort of a little bit disappointed to lose you as a comrade in arms on the advocacy side of the fence. I'm thrilled to stay in touch and continue working with you as you take on your new role. All the best with that. And thanks for joining me for the chat, in which I think it's a brief 4-day interregnum between your old job and your new job. So I really appreciate you making your time and all the best, Damien.
Yeah, thanks, Luke. Look, this has been great. I think I've done plenty of interviews, not a podcast before, so now I can put that on my CV. This has been great. But also, thanks to the EC we've done a lot of talking and a bit of campaigning and policy work together over the years. And the EEC itself kind of started in around the same time I kind of started working for ATA Renew. It's been great, sort of being on the journey with you guys and it's not over yet. Looking forward to working with you guys continuously.
Fabulous. Well, That wraps up this episode of First Fuel. If you have comments, I think, Damien, LinkedIn perhaps is the best way of folk connecting with you.
That'll be the best way.
I did look up your Twitter account and it looked a little unloved.
Yeah, that's right. No, Twitter's haven't engaged too much in recent times.
All right, so we'll say if you have comments for Damien, you can find him on LinkedIn, and I'm on Twitter. My handle is @LukeMenzel. And to keep up to date on the latest in energy efficiency, energy management, and demand response, you can follow the Energy Efficiency Council @EECouncil. If Twitter's not your thing, you can email the team. The address is firstfuel@eec.org.au, and make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to First Fuel in your podcast app of choice. And of course, some episodes of First Fuel are broadcast as they're recorded, so you can jump on Zoom and listen in live. To check out upcoming episode times, you can visit eec.org.au/podcasts. But for now, it's goodbye from us, and we'll catch you soon.